Physics World.
Hello, I'm Hamish Johnston, General Physics Editor of Physics World, and you are very welcome to this episode of the Physics World Weekly Podcast. We're going to be talking about portable X-ray detectors, quantum computing, artificial intelligence, and much, much more. It's the beginning of the academic year here in the UK, and final year students will be thinking about life after university. Physics World Careers 2018 is a complete guide to career opportunities for physics graduates, including advice on how to sharpen your skills for a career in industry and how to tailor your CV so that it makes the most of your business-relevant skills and expertise. Download a copy of Physics World Careers 2018 via the Physics World digital app, which is available for Android and Apple devices. Later in the program, our industry editor Margaret Harris will be here to talk about how new technologies such as quantum computing and neural networks are being used to solve practical problems in physics, such as calculating the properties of an atomic nucleus or searching for planets orbiting distant stars. James Dacey will also be here to talk about what's new on the Physics World website. But first up is Physics World's materials expert Anna Deming. She's back from the Advanced Energy Materials Conference at the University of Surrey. There, she caught up with Surrey's Hashini Thirumani, who has developed a small, portable, and low-power X-ray detector that you can literally wrap around your finger. Here's a recording of their conversation.
And Hashini?
Hashini, yes. Wonderful. So what's the focus of your research?
So my focus was to develop an X-ray detector. So this was my PhD project. I just finished my PhD studies 2 weeks ago. So now I'm a postdoc. So this project was, I did under Professor Ravi Silva and Dr. Imaka Jayavardhana. So basically, if I explain what an X-ray detector is, so X-ray detector can detect the incoming X-ray photons and it convert to electrical charges, and ultimately you can get an X-ray image. If I just give you a brief about the applications that you can use X-ray detectors, you'd get a much more broad idea. So let's say that if you have a fractured bone, or if you want to get a chest X-ray, or to get a mammography test done, basically you have an X-ray detector and you have the specified object, so you sputter them with X-rays and you can get a nice X-ray image. So the current X-ray detector market, there's a well-established X-ray detector market based on silicon cattail detectors, materials high EZ, high atomic number in organic materials. Well, they're quite stable, they're quite efficient. There's a well-established market out there. But unfortunately, there are some drawbacks. I wouldn't say drawbacks. There are some qualities that they don't have. For example, these cattail detectors, they're quite rigid and non-flexible. Therefore, non-flexible. And to operate such detectors, you need very high voltages, like 2,000 voltage. But you need to have a high power supply. Because of that, it's not portable. So our direction was to have a detector, X-ray detector, which could be portable, which could be powered using just a couple of batteries, and which could be flexible as well. Yeah,
right.
So that was our target.
So what are the specific applications for a portable one? You talked about sort of mammographies generally, but perhaps that's usually in a clinic. When would you want a portable?
That's a good point. So let's say that if you have a injured soldier in a war zone, if he has to wait for like days and months over there, you know, just to get an X-ray image done. Let's say if there are portable X-ray sources. If you have a portable X-ray detector as well, if you can couple it with a couple of batteries, then you can get that test done then and there in a rural area using these portable X-ray detectors. And also another point is that in non-destructive testing, which means that you can detect fractures or defects in pipelines or large structures, non-destructive testing is one of the aspects of doing that. So in that case, the current detectors are called X-ray films. So they are not real-time. They're not digital. It's more like a photographic film. This X-ray film, you have to take it to a specialized lab in a dark room. You have to analyze it. So it's time-consuming. So mine is real-time. So because of that, You can use these X-ray detectors in non-destructive testing, let's say to detect a fracture or a defect in a large pipeline. You just wrap around with the X-ray detector because it's flexible and portable, and you can get the X-ray image then and there in their fields.
Right. Yeah. Right. So with all those applications, how do you go about getting a X-ray detector that will operate on a lower voltage?
The current detectors are there around millimeter thickness. The thickness is around centimeter or millimeters, but the detector that we have developed, the thickness is around micromillimeters. So it's really, really tiny. It's really thin. It's like a thickness is around a sheet of paper. So because of that, you need very low voltage to extract charges. Because of that, you can power it using around 10 volts. That's how you do it.
Right, yeah. So if you want smaller voltages to work it, so you go for a smaller structure.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
Right, and what are these structures made of?
So these are made out of inorganic and organic hybrid structures. Inorganic material, as in we're using high atomic number nanoparticles so that they allow you to stop the incoming X-rays, and the organic material that allow you to extract the charge carriers, electrons and holes towards the electrodes. So that's why we use these hybrid material structures in that.
So is this like a scintillator and a current generator in one?
Good point. So right now we are not using scintillators.
Right.
A scintillator, you have to convert the X-ray photons to visible light, and then there has to be another photodetector to convert the visible light to electron charges. So it's a two-step process. Right now, we are not using scintillators, we are using nanoparticles, so therefore the X-ray photons will directly convert to charge carriers. So it's a single-step process. So the charge losses is really minimum in our detector.
Right, so it's much more efficient.
Much more efficient, yes.
Wonderful, great.
Thanks, Anna and Hashini. Physicists have always been early adopters when it comes to computing technology. And in many cases, such as the World Wide Web, physicists have driven technological innovation. Physics World's Margaret Harris joins me to talk about how the next computing revolutions will boost physics. Margaret has put together a special collection on revolutions in computing that is now available on the Physics World website. With previously futuristic technologies like artificial intelligence and even quantum computing now being used for practical applications, Margaret, does it seem like there's an important shift going on in how physicists are using computers?
Well, I think there is, and that comes out in several ways in this collection. You mentioned the World Wide Web, which we're contractually obliged to mention was invented by a physicist at CERN.
That's right. I got the memo.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, one trend we're seeing is that the kind of data challenges that CERN and other big science facilities have been facing for years are now starting to appear in other areas of physics. So one article in the collection discusses how researchers in a small optics lab at the University of California, Los Angeles, they developed an instrument known as a time-stretch quantitative phase imaging microscope, and they're using that to try to image all the cells in a 10 milliliter blood sample to see which ones are cancerous. Well, this instrument captures almost a trillion bits of data per second, and that's within an order of magnitude of the rate that the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. But the LHC has, 300 or 3,000 people to deal with that data. This UCLA lab has, three. So that's a challenge that requires some new ways of thinking and also new computational approaches. And one of those new approaches that is mentioned in the collection is to use machine learning to search large data sets for patterns or pick out interesting needles from this gigantic data haystack. There's one article in the collection that looks at that, particularly at a class of algorithms known as artificial neural networks.
Now that's a term that's bandied about quite freely. What exactly is an artificial neural network?
Well, the author of the article, who's Janelle Shane, a research scientist at an optics firm called Boulder Nonlinear Systems, she explains that a lot better than I can. But a neural network is essentially a computer program with modules that are connected in a way that resembles the structure of a brain. I'm definitely not a neuroscientist, but apparently our experiences in life tend to reinforce certain connections in our brain while others become less strong. And that's effectively what happens in an artificial neural network as well. When the network sort of quote-unquote learns, the strength of the connections between the modules get tuned via trial and error until they're optimized in some way. For example, by maximizing a so-called reward function that lines up with the right answer to a problem. You may have heard, and listeners may have heard about this type of program training itself to play computer games, working out the rules with no prior information just by being told to maximize the game's score. But there are other applications as well, more serious and scientific ones. One major one is image recognition. So if you tell a neural network what it's looking for by training it on a big data set of images that are labeled in some way, such as radiography images that either do or don't contain lung cancer or breast cancer, or maybe images of particular types of galaxies that either do or don't contain gravitational lenses, then the neural network can then go off and find other images of the same type, identify them if you give it a fresh data set. At least that's the idea.
So, as well as doing research in optics, Shane also writes a blog called AI Weirdness, and this highlights some of the foibles of using neural networks. So, her article is very much a cautionary tale. What sort of weird and wonderful results have neural networks delivered, perhaps to unexpected scientists?
Well, there's a wonderful saying among programmers, garbage in, garbage out. And that's definitely true with machine learning. So if you train a neural network on a data set that's garbage in some way, you're going to get garbage answers. And one example Shane gives in the article is of a group of cancer researchers, skin cancer researchers specifically, who tried to get an AI, an artificial intelligence neural network-based program, to identify images of skin cancer. But what they discovered is that they'd accidentally designed a ruler detector instead, because all the biggest tumors had been photographed with rulers next to them for scale. So, but there are some wonderfully silly examples as well. Shane is kind of an expert in this. She specializes in her blog on AI weirdness and giving neural networks silly things to do. So she gave it on one occasion a whole database of paint colors, like paint you use to paint your house, and their names, and then asked it to come up with new ones based on the patterns it detected in paint names.
There's some fantastic names, aren't there,
yeah,
that it's come up with?
Yeah, it spat out things like Burf Pink and Clardic Fug, which do sound maybe to a slightly machine-like alien brain, a bit like, you know, something you might find in the DIY store, but I don't think they're going to appear on the shelves anytime soon.
And I suppose another problem is if you're learning from a data set that somehow has some sort of bias in it, then essentially, you know, just as a person becomes biased by learning from others, the algorithm become biased as well. And I'm guessing that could be a problem as well in applying to science.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is a specific example to this type of neural network program, but there's a great trick is to Google the racist hand soap dispenser, which basically has learned how to detect when someone's hands are in front of it and then to dispense soap. But it's apparently been trained on images of white people's hands, so it doesn't recognize a black person or a brown person's hands as being hands that need to have soap dispensed into them. So yeah, there's excellent. That's a trivial example, but you know, you can think of much more serious examples in terms of, you know, using learning algorithms to sort of identify patterns in crime, for example, that could end up, you know, hurting a lot of innocent people because of the bias that's been fed into the algorithm. Yeah, absolutely. That's an issue.
So a great tool for physicists, but beware.
Yes. Yeah. In short.
Another article in the collection is by US-based nuclear physicists, and it looks at how commercially available cloud quantum computing services have been used to calculate the properties of a very simple nucleus. So what is cloud quantum computing?
Well, so to explain that, let's first just say what cloud computing is generally. Now, it used to be that pretty much everyone, whether they're companies, research groups, labs, private individuals, whatever, stored and processed their data locally. But that's changed. It's become a lot more common for those tasks to be done at some specialist remote facility, like a server farm in Iceland or a supercomputer in California. And in that case, the resource or data is, quote, in the cloud, and you call on it when you need it. It's the same general principle as listening to music on Spotify rather than downloading it off iTunes, although, of course, other platforms are available. So cloud quantum computing brings this idea, which, you know, really only became widespread in the past 5 years or so, into the realm of quantum computing. And a couple of companies, Rigetti and IBM, will give or sell you processing time on their prototype quantum processors, which are physically located somewhere in their own labs. But then you can program them to run your experiment in a remote fashion. And that's what this group of nuclear physicists in the US did to calculate the binding energy of a deuteron.
The authors describe using cloud quantum computing as a liberating experience, and they describe it as a great equalizer with the potential to bring quantum computing to the many. Why is that? What are the benefits of using the cloud rather than running your own quantum computer?
Well, in many ways, it's the same as the benefits of not running your own supercomputer, and actually to the nth degree, because quantum computers and quantum devices generally are still fairly fiddly things. Keeping them running requires specialist know-how and instrumentation that even most physicists don't have, and certainly not most theorists like this group in the U.S. The details depend on the systems you're using as your qubits, your quantum bits, but it might include equipment like sophisticated cryogenics or ion traps. So until these cloud services came along, if you wanted to program a quantum computer to, you know, test something, you needed all that stuff in your own lab, or you needed to have a good friend who did, who was happy to collaborate with you. By offering these services via the cloud, that requirement goes away. Although I should say this is all very much in its infancy, and that the problem that the U.S. scientists were working out has a known solution. It was just a bit of a test bed to try it in a quantum mechanical way. But it'll be really exciting to see how it grows in the future, and I think that this type of service really could be, as the authors say, a great equalizer with potential to make quantum computing accessible to a lot more scientists than it currently is.
Well, thanks, Margaret. You can read about cloud quantum computing, artificial neural networks, and much more in the Physics World Focus on Computing, which you can access via the orange Revolutions in Computing panel on physicsworld.com. Next up, I'm joined by Physics World's Multimedia Projects Editor, James Dacey, to talk about what's new on the website over the past week. Hi, James.
Hi, Hamish. Sorry.
Yeah, not bad. It's been a multimedia extravaganza this week, with new video and audio going up on Physics World. It's also tropical storm season in the Northern Hemisphere, and if you've been paying attention to the news, you know that both East Asia and North America have recently been battered by storms, with flooding claiming lives. Now, your latest video looks at how flood damage from hurricanes can be mitigated. So what's that about?
So we're firmly into hurricane season now, as you said. And this is, it's an interview with a researcher at Louisiana State University, Carol Friedland. So she's a geoscientist. I think her research is quite interdisciplinary. And she's interested in modeling how the risk from hazards associated with hurricanes are changing with climate. So it's looking at water and wind, basically. And she's also interested in building regulations and codes, so looking at whether buildings in the US are fit to deal with these hazards. It's worth checking out the interview, but one of the things she's quite an advocate of is that lots of the buildings on the East Coast, so the area of the US, which is in the firing line for hurricanes, they're not really up to standard for the water hazard. She thinks they're pretty good at resisting wind, but when it comes to water, she reckons they're 7 times more vulnerable to hazards, so to heavy rains and storm surge and all that kind of stuff.
And that's important, isn't it? Because if you look at, you know, the statistics for damage and loss of life for hurricanes, most of it is associated with water, isn't it? With storm surge and flooding and that sort of thing.
It seems to be, and I suppose it's something I hadn't really thought about, but that could well be partly to do with the way these buildings have been constructed and the fact that they are pretty good at withstanding wind. But with, I think with climate change, rains are getting heavier. The average that they always refer to, this 1 in 100 year storm, I think that's becoming meaningless, because these storms are intensifying.
Yeah, that's interesting, James. I mean, it reminds me of there was a very famous incident in Toronto in the 1950s. I should say this is before my time, where, believe it or not, a hurricane called Hazel struck the city. And this was just after massive suburban development, when people didn't really understand where to build houses and where not to. And the hurricane dumped a vast amount of rain onto the city, and neighborhoods were quite literally washed away. And many, many people were killed in this tragedy. And people still talk to it to this day in Toronto. And the upshot of that was that very strict building regulations were built in, were brought in about where you could build houses and where you couldn't. And there was also an incredible amount of work that was done on controlling creeks and streams and rivers to make sure that that it didn't happen again. So, you know, it is interesting how these lessons have been learned, but maybe not fully.
I think, I mean, it's partly to do with the way, the politics and the planning behind it, because you get these sort of federal level recommendations about buildings, but then it's up to individual states whether or not they actually implement these codes. You're meeting demand for from developers. You want to just get on and build stuff. I guess that's something that Carol's research looks at, that sort of balance and the politics behind that, and what needs to be done to actually get these different codes implemented. And it, you know, one of the things they talk about is raising the, what would they call it? Is it sideboards, is it, on the housing? So raising it up a foot, I think, was the amount she mentioned. There's also things that you can do, I suppose, as an individual, such as, you know, leaving the ground floor unoccupied, having a flood room, for example, if you really are in a particularly precarious situation.
Mm. And yeah. And of course it gets strange in places like the Carolinas, doesn't it? Because there seems to be a bit of denial about sea level rise and storm surge and you know, sort of official proclamations that it's not going to happen in some of those places, isn't there? So that sort of muddies the waters quite literally in terms of how people can respond to a growing threat. And you've also got another video up this week, don't you, about, is it earthquakes in Mexico City?
Yeah, that's right. So we're recording this on Wednesday, so it's Wednesday the 19th, and the video's just gone live. So basically today is the 1 year anniversary since the central Mexico earthquake, which struck last year. So that was a 7.1 magnitude earthquake that killed 228 people in Mexico City and damaged the infrastructure as well. So it's a video by Lucina Malesio. So she's one of our regular freelancers. She's based in Mexico City. And it's got animations as well by a guy called Adiv González Muñoz. So he's an astrophysicist who also dabbles in animations and photography. And it's looking at the tectonic and the geographical situation in Mexico City, which means that it is particularly vulnerable to earthquakes. Because 7.1 is, it is big. It's a high number, but it's not sort of a massive scale earthquake. But because Mexico City was built basically on the bed, it's an ancient lake bed from the origins of the city itself, from where the Aztecs settled. And there's something within the geology, the fact that you've got these sort of loose sediments that amplifies the seismic waves as they're passing through. And it also can go on for longer as well, and then it leaves the buildings a lot more vulnerable.
And moving on to audio, I think our regular audio correspondent, Andrew Glester, has been doing the festival circuit for us this summer in the UK, and he's been looking for science at festivals. So what's Andrew been up to?
Yeah, so leaving behind all the hazards and death and moving towards something a bit more cheerful. Andrew's a regular festival goer, and he's also the presenter of our other podcast, which is the monthly podcast, Physics World Stories. This summer he's been at a couple of music festivals that also have quite a strong science communication element as well. First he went to the Blue Dot Festival, which is at the site of the Jodrell Bank Observatory. So it's in Cheshire, near Manchester. That festival is, very, very strong for science. I mean, science is pretty much, the headline act there, because they've got lots and lots of stuff going on. And the second one he went to is the Green Man Festival. So I've been to that a few times actually as well. It's in the Brecon Beacons in Wales.
Oh, lovely. I like the Brecon Beacons.
Yeah, it's a lovely site. You're nestled in the hills there, but the problem is it's very wet as well, obviously. It's in South Wales, late August. Andrew meets various people at these different festivals. And yeah, you can expect poetry, you've got plays inspired by science, good old-fashioned science talks. And yeah, he's just looking at the different innovative ways that you can communicate science. And also it's the challenge of, you know, making science fun, you know, arriving at a place like a festival where people are there to basically have a good laugh, aren't they, and just relax. So trying to find a way of communicating science in that setting in a way that is engaging, fun, but also sort of genuinely communicates some of the messaging.
That's great, James. So where can you find videos and podcasts on the website?
So all of that content, that's all on our website. So if you just go to the audio and video tab. But with the podcast, your best bet is probably to go to the Apple podcast app or the Android equivalent or whatever it is you use. What else is new on the site this week, Hamish? You've been churning out quite a lot of stuff as well.
Yeah, well, we have two fascinating articles about quantum physics this week. One is by Philip Ball, and it's called Putting Quantum Noise to Work. Now, quantum noise, it's different to what physicists think of as classical noise. Classical noise is the random thermal fluctuations of a system. And you can get rid of classical noise simply by cooling down a system and minimizing its fluctuations. But quantum noise, you can't get rid of it. It's sort of a fundamental thing that's a direct result of the uncertainty principle.
So it's kind of this, like a quantum fuzziness.
That's right. It is exactly a quantum fuzziness. Yeah, definitely. In his article, Phil describes why some physicists believe that quantum noise could be used as a resource.
Okay. So is that kind of intrinsic quantum uncertainty, isn't that kind of part of quantum technologies anyway? Isn't that kind of what people have been using for years? How is this different from what we knew already?
Well, what we've known about this for a long time. We've known about, for example, quantum phase transitions, which are driven by quantum noise. But I think people have always seen it as, you know, maybe a hindrance rather than something that could actually be harnessed to do work. I mean, I'm not quite sure what sort of work can be done. But if you want to learn more about that, check out Phil's article. Yeah, and then we've got another article about quantum causality, which was written by me. And I have to admit, it was a real struggle to get my head around the experiment that was done by Jackie Romero, Fabio Costa, and colleagues at the University of Queensland in Australia. The upshot of what they've done is that they've shown that if two different operations are performed on a photon in quick succession, then the photon cannot distinguish which operation was performed first. And that defies the notion of causality. And the physicists say that further work in this field could provide insight into how to combine relativity with quantum mechanics and could also lead to new quantum technologies.
It's quite a bold aim then.
it is a very bold aim. And it's, it goes back to this idea of the uncertainty principle and the fact that you can't peg down a quantum object such as a photon in time. It will have its wave function will have a spread in time. And if that spread in time happens to be larger than, the time between the two operations performed on the photon, well, then, you know, the idea of which operation was performed first becomes meaningless. That sounds great in theory. But, these researchers in Australia have done an experiment that has actually established this, quite amazing.
Are they saying this feature of the quantum realm, is that something that would be good for technologies, or is that something that would be an issue if you're saying you lose this causality? Just at face value, that sounds like that would be difficult for, you know, creating logic operations and that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, it could. It could be useful, for example, to create entangled states. You could have a photon that's in an entanglement of two states, one where A is done before B, the other where B is done before A. And, you know, you, possibly that could be useful in terms of processing quantum information. So, yeah, I mean, it could be a problem in some situations, but I think they're, you know, sort of selling it as something that could be used to develop quantum technologies.
More down here on Earth. So there's something I noticed this week. You published something about climate observation in Africa.
Yeah, we've got a piece that looks at why Africa's network of observation stations for recording greenhouse gas and other emissions is only about 1/25th the size of an equivalent network in Europe. Now, that's according to some research that was done by Veronica York of Thunen Institute of Climate and Smart Agriculture in Germany and an international team of researchers. Their report highlights one of the areas of climate change research where Africa lags behind other continents. And they call for pan-African research infrastructure for greenhouse gas emissions. You can read more in African Climate Research Infrastructure Gears Up by John Cartwright. On the medical physics front, we also report on a new medical imaging technique called deuterium metabolic imaging. Now, this uses deuterium as an MRI tracer to map glucose metabolism. This is important because tumors metabolize glucose faster than healthy tissue, and so the images can be used to detect and monitor cancer. You can read about that in Heavy Hydrogen Tracks Glucose Metabolism in Vivo. That was written by the medical physicist Liam Stubbington. And finally, researchers in France have shown that an extremely strong permanent magnet can be made without using neodymium. Now, the new material comprises of tiny nanorods of cobalt, and this mimics the strong directional dependence of the magnetic properties of neodymium-based magnets. Now, really strong neodymium magnets are used to create lightweight motors and other technologies. And while neodymium is not a particularly rare element, its distribution is uneven across the world. In fact, most of the production occurs in China. As a result, scientists are keen to develop magnets made from other materials, as Merrick Stevens explains in Cobalt Offers Rare Earth Alternatives. For more about these stories and a lively mix of physics, news, features, reviews, and analysis, check out the Physics World website. Thanks again for joining us, and we will be back next week with more from the wonderful world of physics.
Physics World.